Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I'm on. Good evening, everyone. I'm Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. As always, I am doing this, you know, for any of you who don't know, I'm doing this from my office in my house. And sometimes I miss 9 o'clock by about 15 seconds. Sometimes that's because I've slept through it. As some of you know, I have an extreme issue with sleep, and my sleep schedule is on a non-24-hour schedule. So same thing every day is a little difficult for me, but today is not one of those days. Today is one of those days that I just missed the start button by 15 seconds because I got caught up in this email that I was just sent. But if you want to call into the show and talk, this is an open line show. The number to call is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. I want to say hello to all of you, and I'm hoping that you're enjoying this whole process here. It's been quite the trip for me. And I'll talk a little bit about that, too. But if you need a toll-free line, the number to call is area code 855-346-3351, 855-346-3351. So the email that I was caught up in, or the link that I was sent, was from a psychiatric news article published August 1st, 2014. Sue, thanks for listening, and thanks for always sending me stuff. And so the title of this article is Oxytocin Nasal Spray Fails to Improve Social Functioning in Psychosis Patients. It was written by Mark Moran. And I'll reserve my comments, but I'll read the first sentence. And the first sentence is, it, quote, improving cognition and cognitive skills related to social functioning is a vital research area, since these variables are seen as major obstacles to improved daily functioning for people with schizophrenia. And so what they're having them do, apparently, is that there's this oxytocin nasal spray. And when you go and you look up what oxytocin is, you can find an article if you just, you know, Google it. You find multiple articles, but there's an article on psychocentral.com called About Oxytocin, which actually links to Wikipedia, it seems. So oxytocin is a hormone, just in case you don't know what oxytocin is. So it's actions of this, I'm reading this from Psych Central, and which I guess was originally from Wikipedia. Actions of oxytocin within the brain. Oxytocin secreted from the pituitary gland cannot re-enter the brain because of the blood-brain barrier. Instead, the behavioral effects of oxytocin, and I might be saying this wrong, are thought to reflect release from centrally projecting oxytocin neurons, different from than those that project to the pituitary gland. All right, this is real science-y, but in a second, you're going to see what this thing does. And it's my understanding it's a hormone. And so oxytocin receptors are expressed by neurons in many parts of the brain and spinal cord, including the amygdala, ventromedial hypothalamus, septum, and brainstem. Okay, so all different parts of the brain, and I know that the amygdala, which some people might say amygdala, or some other version of that, A-M-Y-G-D-A-L-A, is responsible for when you experience new emotions for the first time. Like, you know, I very often will say to students, okay, try to remember, you know, close your eyes, and, you know, you're not going to say this to anybody. This is just for your own personal benefit. Try to remember the last time. I mean, not the last time, the first time you laughed because you found something funny. The first time in your life that you laughed because you found something funny. Try to remember what that was. Okay, Got it? Maybe? Yes? No? Okay, hold it to yourself. Now I want you to close your eyes and think to the first time that you ever really felt betrayed or lied to in some way. Right? Okay, right? So the usual response is that people immediately or close to immediately can remember the first time that they felt betrayed or lied to on some level, but have a much more difficult time remembering the very first time that they found something funny. And so I think that that's one of the things that we need to look at, just even if only anecdotally, that as humans, we have access to five emotions that are generally negative and one that is generally positive, happiness, and surprise, which can go either way. So the whole idea that they're having people snort hormones that wind up affecting sexual arousal and bonding, along with a whole bunch of other things. Well, what they found was that it worked as well as the placebo. Right? It says, the study findings were published on June 23rd in Schizophrenia Bulletin. Oxycontin, Mark Moran continues in Psychiatric News, is a hormone that has been associated with empathy and other factors critical to social functioning. Some preliminary studies have suggested that oxytocin might benefit patients with psychosis. Mark Moran writes, especially with regard to the cognitive and social deficits experienced by, Moran says, schizophrenia patients. Okay, so removing the language for a second, like this is really what they're looking at. And when you look further down of like what Wikipedia has listed with all of these things, included all kinds of, I'm just going to read the bullet points. Autism, maternal behavior, increasing trust and reducing fear, affecting generosity by increasing empathy during perspective taking. According to some studies in animals, oxytocin inhibits the development of tolerance to various addictive drugs, such as opiates, cocaine, and alcohol, and reduces withdrawal symptoms. Preparing fetal neurons for delivery. Crossing the placenta, maternal oxytocin reaches the fetal brain and induces a switch in the action of a neurotransmitter or whatever, GABA. And okay, so this is just getting all kinds of whatever. But certain learning and memory functions are impaired by centrally administered oxytocin. These are all different studies about it. That they're listing here that you can go look at and try to find. And then the last one is MDMA, ecstasy, may increase feelings of love, empathy, and connection to others by stimulating oxytocin activity, the activation of serotonin SHT1A receptors. If initial studies in animals apply to humans. See, all right, so I was just going to say, you know, this is such a load. Here we go, blowing the whole thing again. And then, you know, that whole important final point, if initial studies in animals apply to humans. So they're saying this stuff without proof, but, yeah, apparently they're having people sniff or nasal spray. I don't know. I guess it's not really sniff. I don't know what it is. Spray oxytocin into their nose. And that it didn't work as well as the placebo. Let me see if I could just find that exact sentence so that I can pull in. So if you would like to call in to the show, the number to call is 267-521-0167. Yeah, and so what appears to be the first randomized controlled trial of oxytocin nasal spray for patients with early psychosis found no benefit over placebo with regard to social functioning. So so my other point, okay, after having gone through all of that, right, my other point is why are all of these people who are getting paid, who knows how much money to design these studies, why it's evident that they don't know the first thing about what they're talking about, because if they ever experienced any of this, they wouldn't just simply be able to write it off. They just simply wouldn't be able to write it off as a biological thing and be searching for that. But even when they're doing it within the range of these hormones, I mean, it's a whole other thing. So if you'd like to call in and talk, 267-521-0167. I'm not pretending that I understand every bit of the science of this. As a matter of fact, I don't think I'm ever saying that. What I'm saying is all of their reports seem to end with the word of if or maybe or, you know, someday. And what I'm saying is why is it that their non-existence of proof for their theory that this is all just simply biochemical or hormonal, they have no evidence. I have no quote-unquote evidence. Why do they win? Why do they win? And that's what I want to know. And if the answer is anything other than, I mean, at the end of the day, where do we wind up coming? That this is billions, trillions, who knows how many zillions of dollars over time, that profit in medicine is a huge part of the problem. The other huge part of the problem is state power. What would happen if tomorrow we took the profit out and we just said no more profit, no more profit in anything that any industry makes? There will be a level of, I bet you there'd be no more forced treatment if there was no more profit. If all that was generated was enough money to pay for the function of creating it and a reasonable existence for those who were in those positions, what would happen? Trillions of dollars, gazillions of dollars. What would happen if for like 2 minutes, like, people weren't as concerned about how much something costs as, in consumerism in general? Like, you know, it goes back to that 12 Monkeys. Anybody ever see 12 Monkeys? It goes back to that kind of movie where, you know, you have that whole speech that he makes about, you know, that consumers, that you're buying this and you're buying that and you're listening to what the ads tell you and and the reason that you get locked up in a mental institution is because you're not buying the things that society says you should be buying. And that is definitely no, without doubt, I'm really not doing well tonight. It's a problem. It's just a problem. And so I'm talking myself in circles. I'm talking to myself in public. Anybody want to call and talk with me? 267-521-0167. If you want to call in, if you need a 800, toll-free line, rather, it's 855-346-3351. 855-346-3351. Let's see. So there's been a lot of things going on all over the place. I've been, because school starts again soon, I've been, reading textbooks and PowerPoint slides developed by educational companies and such. And I got to tell you, it's in there. There's messaging. There's no two ways around it. From the very earliest of days, people are being programmed that all of this is okay and that you don't really need to look at it other ways. And the information in some of the textbooks is not necessarily the ones that I'm using. I'm trying my damnedest to really find good books, and I have, you know, made selections. But some of the texts just are outright misinformation, and not reflective of what the federal government states, what the device makers are mandated to state, what the, you know, the electroconvulsive, the electroshock machine, for example. There's just so little honesty inside of how material is presented to people, and it is really pretty horrifying. And the books, I've noticed over time, when I first started teaching Intro to Psych, the books all started with a history chapter, and now the first chapter is biological psychology. And so even the history of what's happened to people over time, people who I have been put in a group of by people in another group that I now also am part of, which is really disturbing. It remains disturbing to me, the association with psychology. But I got it. So I'm going to try to get it back to at least being honest. Over 9 years, this is 9 full years that I've now taught at an adjunct level undergrad psychology classes. And in the Intro to Psychology books, they don't even talk really about the history. And so it makes people totally separate out from knowing those days of the asylums, of knowing those days of the poorhouses, when we were just entirely, literally chained to stone walls in basements, naked with bales of hay to lay on, in dirt floors in the 1800s, right? That's the poor in almshouses. That was what Dorothea Dix, for as much as she is not a friend of this movement, and the idea that she's like hailed as a, mental health advocate just irritates the life out of me, because she created the asylums, and she believed in corporal punishment, and, she was a Southern sympathizer, for God's sakes. I love being done with school and being able to make opinionated statements again, but I can also say it in a way that has nothing to do with my opinion in it, and it's not, even my opinion, because it's just a bunch of stuff that I found that other bunch of people wrote that I wound up putting together in a way that they hadn't. And some of that was because I used books that spanned over, 100 years. And so some people who uncovered things, at different points of time couldn't put all of this together then. And certainly the people who were living it out, who might have had access to shine light on what was going on, either didn't want that light spotlighted, or when they spoke out, like Clifford Beers, they were, assigned psychotic and locked up in a institution to die. And today we give Clifford Beers an award too. So I don't really get why we keep on having these conversations very often with professionals, and why they're so opposed to, even having a discussion around human rights. Or if you're talking about rights, then you're either like somebody who's not credible. If one more person says, if I hear one more person talking about the fact that if you talk about human rights or things that happen to people who are psychiatrically assigned as torture or murder or slavery or genocide or any of these things that is done to us on a regular basis, that all of a sudden you're not credible, and that's radical. And it's like, maybe if they weren't being taught these lies all through their education, where the history is ripped out washed over a million times, so that nobody ever has to deal with it. Because I can't think of why this system, I mean, talk about, like, history repeating on you. It's like somebody get some antibacterial spray or something, because we are going to get so sick all over again because they're doing the same thing. And so, you know, there are calls out from people to talk to your congresspeople and your representatives and, you know, remind people that you're opposed to H.R. 3717 and the Murphy Bill, the Helping Families and Mental Health Crisis Act. Talk to all of your legal representatives. Start addressing what kinds of bills that you want them to support and what kinds of bills you don't want them to support, because whether or not 3717 or any of these current bills wind up getting through to Senate or getting, you know, as they get rewritten or whatever, however they're repositioned afterwards, so that you're, the people who are representing you at the level of making law and legislation know how it is you want them to vote, and that you have the power of the vote, and that you have friends and coworkers and loved ones that live in that person's district, and you can organize, and you can show that to these people by inviting them to different, you know, events that you're planning. Hold something at the public library or something in a meeting room and invite your local representative down to talk to people. Or just take 20 or 30 of your closest friends and walk over to their local office one day and say, you'd like to talk, and that you really think that their position should be to stop the Murphy Bill or any version of this, and here's why. And develop that relationship with people. I think that this is so essential for people to understand that we have it in, the power in our own hands. And there have been examples of how that has successfully happened. For instance, what Aubrey Shomo and others in Colorado were recently involved with in saving the jury trial, and how they are now going after, you know, making sure that, I think it's Beth McCann, knows the position and is going to stop going after people who are psychiatrically assigned. But that these are rights issues. These are things that other people in American society are not having to be subjected to. And it's all because of this assignment. So if they, like the other day we were talking about this being like, you know, where they're saying that now they may have found, you know, the genetic link to suicide, SKA2, gene SKA2, like, you know, may have, might have, in the future, someday, it might. And then what are you going to do? Take a blood test of people and say, oh, you're close to, wanting to end your life. So we're going to have to now, based on this gene, what this gene says, we're going to now have to take away all of your rights, and, you know, and then what? And lock them up, watch them, put them in some kind of quarantine. What? And so, if you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167. And you know, I think it's important to know that there are people who worked in psychiatry and other places that have, like, thrown their hands up and said, no way, no more, not another second. And so, Sue, again, thank you. Lauren Mosier, who, you know, Soteria House, would not exist without Lauren Mosier. His biography on MosierSoteria.com, you know, is lengthy. And, you know, unfortunately, he died in 2004. But before then, he really did a phenomenal amount to change the ways that people were, the way people experience things. And so it says in his bio, from 1970 to 1992, He was a collaborating investigator, the research director of the Soteria Project, Community Alternatives for the Treatment of Schizophrenia. In this role, he was instrumental in developing and researching an innovative, non-drug, non-hospital, home-like residential treatment facility for acutely psychotic persons. And Soteria House, and there's several of them in the country, without it, we would not be the same. And so he has a letter of resignation from the American Psychiatric Association on the 4th of December, 1998. It said, Loren R. Mosier, M.D., and his name is L-O-R-E-N, R. Mosier, M-O-S-H-E-R, to Rodrigo Munoz, M.D., president of the American Psychiatric Association. Dear Rod, Mosier writes, after nearly three decades as a member, it is with a mixture of pleasure and disappointment that I submit this letter of resignation from the American Psychiatric Association. The major reason for this action is my belief that I am actually resigning from the American Psychopharmacological Association. Luckily, the organization's true identity requires no change in the acronym. Unfortunately, APA reflects and reinforces in word and deed our drug-dependent society. Yet it helps wage war on, quote, drugs. Quote, dual diagnosis clients are a major problem for this field, but not because of the, quote, good drugs we prescribe. Quote, bad ones are those that are obtained mostly without a prescription. A Marxist would observe that being a good capitalist organization, APA likes only those drugs from which it can derive a profit, directly or indirectly. That's where we went back to before, right? Profit. What would happen if you took the profit out of psychiatry? So Mosier continues, this is not a group for me. At this point in history, in my view, psychiatry has been almost completely bought out by the drug companies. The APA could not continue without the pharmaceutical company support of meetings, symposia, workshops, journal advertising, grand rounds luncheons, unrestricted educational grants, etc., etc. Psychiatrists, Mosier says, have become the minions of drug company promotions. APA, of course, maintains that its independence and autonomy are not compromised in this enmeshed situation. Anyone with the least bit of common sense attending the annual meeting would observe how the drug company exhibits and, quote, industry-sponsored symposia, draw crowds with their various enticements, while the serious scientific sessions are barely attended. Psychiatric training reflects their influences as well. The most important part of a resident's curriculum is the art and quasi-science of dealing drugs, i.e. prescription writing. Mosier, 1998, this is from. If you'd like to call in, well, I know there are a bunch of you there online. Hi, I just switched over to the studio again. If any of you want to talk, remember to hit 1 or star 1 to get my attention. And if you'd like to call in and talk, the number is 267-521-0167, 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, it's 855-346-3351. So back to Mosier's resignation letter from the American Psychopharmacological Association, the Psychiatric Association, 1998. So this is, what, 2014? So 16 years ago, is that right? I don't know. My math is terrible. No, it's probably not 16 years. It's 14. 18. I don't know. Anybody know how long ago this was? Feel free to give me a call and let me know. So Mosier continues, these psychopharmacological limitations on our abilities to complete physicians also limit our intellectual horizons. No longer do we seek to understand whole persons in their social contexts. Rather, we are there to realign our patients' neurotransmitters. The problem is that it is very difficult to have a relationship with a neurotransmitter, whatever its configuration. Sorry. That's just so funny to me. This is why I liked Mosier, because he really, was able to just get it right out there. So the problem, I'll read that sentence again. The problem is that it is very difficult to have a relationship with a neurotransmitter, whatever its configuration. So our guild organization provides a rationale by its neurobiological tunnel vision for keeping our distance from the molecule conglomerates we have come to define as patients. We condone and promote the widespread use and misuse of toxic chemicals that we know have serious long-term effects. This is Dr. Lauren Mosier. Tardive dyskinesia, tardive dementia, and serious withdrawal symptoms. So do I want to be a drug company patsy who treats molecules with their formulary? No, thank you very much. It saddens me that after 35 years as a psychiatrist, I look forward to being you can tell how they got me on that one, right? No, thank you very much, Lauren Mosier writes. Dr. Mosier says, it saddens me that after 35 years as a psychiatrist, I am looking forward to being dissociated from such an organization. In no way does it represent my interests. It is not within my capacities to buy into the current biomedical reductionistic model heralded by the psychiatric leadership as once again marrying us to somatic medicine. This is a matter of fashion, politics, and like the pharmaceutical house connection, money. If you'd like to talk, area code 267-521-0167, area code 706, your line is open.
Hey, Lauren, it's Jen Padron, and Sharon Kretzinger.
No way. Hey.
Way.
Hello.
I'm listening to your show. Hello. How are you?
Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Sharon. I'm doing great, thanks. What do you want to talk about?
Well, we liked when you were reading Lauren Mosier's letter and you almost said dissociated.
Yeah. I think disassociation is actually the right way to refer to it, actually. I don't know if it was supposed to say associated or dissociated, but it sounded okay to me.
Thanks. but yeah, that was my that's my conditioning, I guess.
I think this whole biomedical thing, Lauren, I think the whole thing is just a crock of, you know what, I don't know a whole lot about it, but it just doesn't make any sense to me. The whole model doesn't work. It's not okay, I think.
I don't think it's okay either. I think that it's clear to me, like from just a research perspective, if I could get like in that kind of world for just a moment, I don't want to stay too long. But don't you need to know something about the problem, supposed problem that you're looking at before you start coming up with research designs? Like, who designs this? And who has people walking around? Can you imagine? I want you to take this nose stuff and stick it up your nose and, you know, spray it whenever you feel like you need to go out and have a social or cognitive experience.
I mean, what's up with the labels?
I mean, and if that's the case, why don't they just go back to Freud and give everybody cocaine? Like, what the hell?
Right.
Like, do you know what I mean? Yeah, it just, if you're really trying to boost the ability for people who are assigned this thing that they have no proof of existing, being able to go out and, like, have fun and have sex and, like, connect with people and stuff like that, right? Because that's what the oxytocin hormone does.
Yeah. It's thought
provoking. Give them cocaine. Give them cocaine.
Yeah,
like, that's there was a letter from Freud to Anna before they were married while they were courting where he sent her an eighth of cocaine and directed her how to cut it up and said that the next time that she saw him, he would be a wild man on cocaine. And, you know, and this is what this is what psychiatry had to offer in 1900. So,
well, that was the man who was serious about getting married.
Yeah. Of course, he sold out all people because he knew that the problem was that these women were being sexually assaulted, and that was what was causing the quote-unquote hysteria. And instead, because it was unpublishable, because it was seen as, not publishable in 1900, he made the Oedipus complex up, where, you know, little boys were attracted to their mothers and little girls were attracted to their fathers. And why that was publishable in 1900, I don't understand. If the other was seen as obscene, why?
Because it's all a white man. It's all a patriarchal system that is misogynistic. But on top of that, back then, good Lord, look at everything that was going on. I'm not defending them, but it's terrible. It's terrible what's happening now. It just pisses me off.
It really is. It really is. What's the worst part of it to you? I mean, there's so many to choose from, but...
The worst part of it to me, the work that I'm in, the work that I do in the mountainous region of North Georgia, I see a lot of forced psychiatry. I see a lot of seclusion and restraint. I see a lot of people being shot up with Haldol. They have to come in for monthly shots, and if they don't do it, they get put in handcuffs and taken away. You know, I've got a major problem with that.
Yeah. It's terrible, and it's abuse and torture and murder, and so speaking out about it, is it easy to speak out about where you are? Is it welcomed if you, like...
I can't among my peers. I cannot among the clinicians. I cannot among... management. If I did, I would lose my job, and I need it. But what I do in the meantime is I provide peer services and peer supports one-on-one and in group, and I provide as much assistance as I can to help these individuals move on, and to get hope again, because they're, a lot of these people just have no hope. It's so diminished. It's a rural region, so I'm sure you can imagine the issues.
Complicated in all kinds of different ways, right? I find one of the most horrible things that people from places, rural places, have told me, one rural place, this one person told me once, was that they really wanted the services to come, and they rallied for the state to invest money, and then the services got there, and they were like, whoa, no, this isn't what we wanted. And then they all rallied to try to get rid of them.
Yeah.
And the disappointment in people thinking that they're going to wind up getting something and then being exposed to this kind of torture and abuse and the restraint and seclusion and all of this, it really is awful.
Well, I experienced it firsthand in Texas. When I was very, very, very sick, only 10 years ago, I mean, I was in that position, and, I understand what it's like to be on the other end, and so what I do now is what I do best, and that's helping other people that were there where I was and that I understand so well. And, it falls under the description of doing peer supports and peer services as a certified peer specialist. I do that, and I'm also a community health worker. So I do what I can, but I love it, and it's not work. It's just like every day I get to get up and do this. I mean, how cool is that?
Yeah. When you get to do what you love, it's not work, right? I feel like there are so many things, and you're getting close to being done, right?
Yeah. Yes, I took the summer off. I've got an LOA, but I've got to go back. We start in September, and I'm like, getting ready for the proposal for the 1, 2, 3. And then after that, I've got my data analysis, which is chapter 4, and then 5 I close out, and I walk out, hopefully, by the end of the spring next year. Yay.
And when you walk out, how do you walk out?
Well,
for anybody who might not know.
That you posted, did you see the graduation picture you posted on Facebook?
What's that?
Did you see your do you remember your graduation picture when you got out of school that you posted on Facebook? It was fabulous.
Yes.
That is exactly how I will be feeling, if not 10 times more.
It was definitely a good day, and it was fun wearing the Stop Forced Mental Health Treatment T-shirt at the graduation.
Yeah.
And walking around with robes open throughout Lincoln Center like that, and having it be there. Yeah, it was definitely. I was so relieved that it was over, but. So you're close, and that's really exciting. And if at any point you want to come on and talk about the actual what you wind up doing and all of that, that would be great.
Well, I'll invite you to my graduation. How's that? Hopefully it'll be in Maryland. Hopefully it won't be snow.
That's great. I do so bad at any kind of large gathering. Actually, it's like pulling teeth to get me out of the house at all. That's really exciting. I look forward to what you come up with. And so I think that there's still. Some glimmers of this alternatives to an alternatives conference kind of conversation going on. Am I right about that?
You know, I hope so. You know, I was talking to Sharon tonight over dinner at the diner, and earlier before that, we were like, are you going to go to alternatives this year? Are you going to go? I mean, I really want to. I submitted something to present, but I also got accepted to present at the American Public Health Association conference in New Orleans in November, so I'm just not sure if I'll be able to afford it, but I was telling her how cool it is. Alternatives is cool because you see all your friends, you know, but then you also see people that aren't there, and, you know, there's like a hole there. But I would be interested in seeing what kind of a conference could come about or any kind of a gathering, you know, with the different, you know, people from throughout, you know, that would like to be there. But, I mean, in 2012, we had a cool conference that was like a pre-conference to NAPS. That was held in Philadelphia. You know, National Association of Peer Specialists.
They're not the ones who just put out that horrible statement, are they?
Well, now they're called INAPS. Steve Harrington's
the
director.
They are. What the hell was that about?
What was it?
It was. Oh, let me see if I can find it. I don't want to misquote myself saying something horrible, but it was. Some pretty offensive kind of statement when they were called out for being offensive.
Really?
Yeah, and I just don't know where it is right now, and I don't want to say the wrong thing because it was that offensive, and I don't want to. Well, I don't even know if it's worth repeating exactly, but yeah, there was some issue about how they were going about doing things or something like that.
Wow. It would be an awful thing, especially because, you know, I know Steve Harrington. I know Steve. We go back, and I consider him a mentor. And what he's doing right now with leadership, the idea of leadership, and, you know, is a good thing. I would like to see the conference that's going to be here in Atlanta for INAPS. I think it's October the 11th or the 13th. I'm not sure. But it's in town. I mean, I can drive to it, and it would be kind of cool to see him again and see other people that are going to be there, you know, like Lynn Legere probably and Zach and a lot of the outstanding people. But I'd be interested in finding out what that statement was about.
I'm trying to, and if anybody out there knows what I'm talking about and want to come in here and bail me out while I'm looking for it, 267-521-0167, 267-521-0167.
Sharon's looking it up on her iPhone. Sharon's looking it up on her iPhone. Hold on. Yeah, but anyways, I guess if I were going to ask you a question, I would want to know,
What are your hopes and dreams, and what are your goals, and what are you going to be doing with all this work that you're doing right now that's fantastic? I want to know.
What am I doing with this stuff? Well, I hope someday to have the embargo lifted off the entire dissertation. I was so determined to use the exact quotes from different people because I feel like if people had to read the exact things that these people wrote, that they wouldn't be able to, because of copyright issues, nobody can just say, this person said this, right, in any kind of great length. And so everybody waters down or alters whatever it was, like Goffman, for example, was saying. And so I wanted people to see that. So there's while I figure out the copyright issues to be able to get it all online, which should happen within about a year. I would
love to read it. I look forward to it.
Thanks. There are some pieces that, like, I'd like to try to put up, like, the last chapter that was basically just me, you know, talking about, like, as a review of everything and things like that, that I'd like to get up just individually someday soon, and then getting the videos out. I think that there were so many people who participated. The last thing that I want is for this to just, you know, sit in a box someplace and never get beyond itself. Because there was so much important information. And like what you said before, like if you talked about these things, that you'd get fired. And so one of the main findings of Devoiced was that when people speak out against their employers when they're in peer roles, that they're silenced and retaliated against, and that retaliation ranges from loss of position or loss of power in position all the way to being institutionalized and drugged again. And so...
Yeah.
Like, these are, like, you know, this is not, like, I'm calling it a national epidemic. And I think it's that something that, like, any taxpayer should be concerned about this, that all of these people who are working in the mental illness industry, quote-unquote mental illness industry, are being silenced and retaliated against when they speak out against it. And as taxpayers, we trust our government to do the very best for its citizenry. And all of these people who are trying to speak out against it are being silenced. And zillions over time of taxpayer dollars are going into this. And anybody who speaks out against it winds up being seen as not credible. If one more person tells me that I'm not credible or tells somebody who's saying the same kind of thing that I'm saying that they're not credible, like, I'm just going to hit the roof. Like, human rights is not a radical statement. There's no radicalness in saying that people should not be, forced, drugged, and tied down to beds and shot up with drugs and left in rooms by themselves for days on end and treated in the way in which we're treated. It just, that's not radical.
I have horror stories. Yeah, I have horror stories of colleagues and friends that also live with shared life experience of just the horrible things that we had to live through to get to this point. I don't know about you, but I went through a lot of quote unquote invasive, clinically necessary treatments, you know, like ECT for about 2 years. And it hurt. I lost how many memories? How many years have I lost? A lot.
That's really, really, really a lot. I don't even know how people do it. I certainly was not subjected to electroshock, although, and so for people who are shock survivors, I'm beyond myself on it very often, but...
Can I tell you that the numbing me helped save my life for that time period? I mean, I survived it, and I'm here, you know, to talk about it or share it. But I don't recommend it at all to anybody at this point, you know, because of the fallout from that. But I was lucky because I had a partner who was supportive, and she was there the whole time with me, and that's what helped me survive. You know, having someone have faith in me and tell me, you know, you're not this. You know, you can do more. You can be more.
Right. That's, I mean, that's so important, and that there are people who survive it, and a lot of people who listen and tune into this have talked about their experiences of surviving it and what they have to go through every day because of it. And I know that, I have my own, I'm not really talk about a lot of my own experiences around my memories of this, even though I didn't, I've even already said too much. But I know that when I was 15 years old and locked up, that what the office, New York State Office of Mental Health uses today as the criteria for being allowed to use it on a 15-year-old or somebody, you know, a minor, is exactly who they would have said, like, what is they bothered to write about or cared about, meets the criteria exactly for who's allowed to have it used as a minor today in New York State. And so I have a particular passion about it also for young people because, like, that I know that that would not have helped.
So
I mean, so I think that it's that. I mean, when you talk about, like, what are my passions and goals for these things, I think at some point actively bringing this agenda back to young people, which is how I got involved in all of this in the first place, because I was, you know, 7 or 8 when I started involvement with them and 15 the first time I was locked up. And so I came out of the youth movement. And so that's really, I think, if getting this stopped on young people is just essential. And the whole process of it. And quite frankly, hoping that I don't, you know, that someday somebody doesn't say, you know, okay, Lauren, you've clearly gone over the line, and, you know, all of your nice little grandiose things, like, very convenient that you were able to get a book published, very convenient that you were able to get into and out of a PhD program, like, that's all great, but this one, this is too far, and you need to be on medication, and you need, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not some, like, grandiose scam, you know, in my mind that I have that, you know, whatever it is. And so the idea that now or at some point in the future, you know what I mean? Like, elderly women, what they do to elderly women, that you know, someday I fear getting back involved with the system in a way that is not on my terms.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that everyone is at risk of and everyone needs to fear. And they may say I'm crazy for saying that, but I really, truly believe that.
Yeah.
And so that's why the show. That's why trying any which way to get to the mainstream media. And Jen, if you'll stay on the line. And Sharon, area code 803, your line is open. Hello, 803, are you there? Oh,
sorry, I had it on mute. This is Kara. This is Carolina. Hi.
Hi, that's okay. Who is this?
This is Gareth in
Gareth,
South
hey.
Oh, hi, Lauren. Hi, Jen.
How you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I just wanted to respond to... it's really great to hear y'all. I wanted to respond
thanks
to hearing...
Thanks for calling back in. I owe you an email, actually.
Hi. Oh, you going to send your dissertation?
I am going to send you through email. I think we just lost Jen and Sharon, so if you're there and you want to call back in, please do. I definitely, if you could send me your email again, because it got lost inside of it. By the time I got back to New York, I couldn't find it the last time we spoke. But I knew it had come, and I just can't find it again. So if you can send me another email, that would be great, and I'll send it over to you. I'll send, like, one of the final draft of it over.
Oh,
Because as I was saying before, it's still under an embargo.
Yeah, okay. I heard you. So I was just hearing Jen talk, and Jen and I have a lot of experiences in common that we've, you know, been colleagues and so forth. And talking about the exploitation and the silencing of people identified as peers in various companies and agencies. You know, that just resonates with me so much. I have really stepped aside from that work that I was doing. It became really difficult for me to stay in it because of that. And I just really haven't processed it all, but it's very true. I mean, what Jen was saying, she said something sounded like, if I had said something about it, I would have lost my job. Is that what she said exactly?
I'm not sure exactly, but I think we definitely did have a conversation around that. Yeah, because that's when I brought up the findings from Devoiced about, yeah, I don't think it was her point, but I think she mentioned it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jen, if you're out there and want to call back in, 267-521-0167. I hope I didn't cut you off when I brought in Gareth. Okay.
So anyway, I had felt that way while I was working as my job title was peer specialist for, I don't know, I guess about 8 years. And there were so many times when I felt silenced, and I don't know if that was imposed on me or if it was from within or both, probably both. But in the last job I had where I was hired to be a peer specialist, I observed a lot of issues with what seemed to me to be exploiting the peer staff, and there were a lot of other people at the agency who agreed with that, and yet there was a lot.
What kind of agency was it? Was it a traditional provider-run agency or
a private company that was under subcontract to do some mental health work?
Okay, so it was like all kinds of different provider type people, and then peers working inside of it.
Yeah, and there were some people who were hired that were specifically slotted in to be peers, and then some others who were slotted in to be clinicians, and they were treated really differently and divided, and the peers, I felt like they were just, I felt like we were being exploited.
She lost her job because she was home.
Yes. Jen, your line is open.
Hello. Hi, Gareth. Jen.
Hey, Jen, you're back.
Hey, yeah, I'm back. I'm sorry. I thought I was supposed to hang up when I was done or when we were done, so I just called back in. But, yeah, this is a really interesting topic. I struggle with it every day. But, you know, I can do a lot of good while I'm here, and I came here to Georgia. Because to me, it was like coming to the mothership. I mean, Gareth helped recruit me to the company that we're talking about. And I'm forever grateful to Gareth for that, and I love Gareth. And But I also came here to check out what it was like to work in a rural location. And I work in the 14-county mountainous rural region here, which is rather large. And I love rural public health. I do. But the things that I have to deal with, you know, as a peer, even though I'm designated as at a different title with the group, is tough. It's challenging. It's good. I try to redirect myself so that I can focus on the good.
I think that's the position that a lot of people find themselves in, and it's definitely a struggle. And I think that, you know, I think so from Devoiced, one of the things that I really am hoping that we will be able to do is get that message out there. So for people who are working in the field, A, to be aware of it, B, for when it's happening, it's research that people can now point to that says, wait a second, there's research that says that this is something that happens that's specific to this position and situation. Do you know what I mean? To make it not less, more possible to fight administration. And, you know, part of my experience was, of course, this is part of what happened to me several different times in several different ways throughout my working in the movement. for the state or at a peer-run organization or whatever. And I wanted to be able to say, no, this is really what's happening. I'm not crazy. I don't need to be locked up. Like now that I know, like that's what happened to Clifford Beers, you know, diagnosed psychotic, died in an institution, and that this needs to be addressed, and that taxpayers need to be aware of this practice. And part of what I really was able to show in the research was where it was limited, because anytime we came in touch with the overwhelming majority of, you know, professionals who would talk to me, which aren't many, you know, there aren't too many psychiatrists or psychologists who want to have an actual conversation with me, they would say that they were in the same position. And so it wasn't only limited to the discrimination based on psychiatric label, but even psychiatrists who rejected it also then were kind of assigned some kind of special kind of madness by their colleagues. So, you know, we need to be able to talk about it, I guess, is the bottom line in my mind.
Yeah, you know, Gareth, are you still there, Gareth?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I mean, you know, Gareth, I'm gonna brag about you a little bit, okay? Gareth was
Oh my gosh.
Gareth did this fantastic job at a university, and she a lot of her work was educational and outreach and also liaison and you know, helping to develop you know, all sorts of initiatives, and she was fantastic at it. And, you know, Gareth is really kind of humble. She's done a lot of stuff at the national level. She's award-winning. She knows a lot about cultural competency and linguistic diversity and blah, 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 and she's just amazing. And but I think what it takes at this point is just education, you know, pound education in and show with the data how we're so wonderfully capable of complementing the services that are either a local mental health authority or a state hospital or a private or public, you know, mental health organization, you know, whether it's cost or not. I think there's also a lot of internalized stigma within our own community, and I think a lot of it's going to take education and people are willing to be patient to do that.
Wow.
Thank you, Jen.
You're welcome.
But I think, as probably anyone who knows us knows, Lauren's work and mine are kind of going in not always the same direction. And the kind of education that I've done is more around the lines of reforming things and making them better, as I see it, which doesn't fully address the human rights objections that that I hear from Lauren and others. So, I mean, on the one hand, yeah, I mean, thanks for the kudos, but on the other hand, I'm kind of, you know, cooperating with and collaborating within a system that fundamentally I do accept and want to change rather than take away.
And I think those were interesting conversations that we've started having, and I look forward to them as they continue, because I think they're different things. I mean, but I want to say it's not just the human rights violations that I have issue with; it's also the fraud. One leads to the other and allows the public to allow them. The fraud allows them to commit the human rights violations. Because the public is operating in the idea that these people have legitimacy behind them, and so I think, it's big and complicated. It really is.
Yeah, you know, the human rights violations, you know, and everything that's going on to, you know, people like us, you know, how do you go about internally changing the system? I don't know if it's possible at this point, because there's so much muck, there's so much static, and within our recovery community here in the U.S., you know, we need to build some, or you know, just kind of work with developing bridges, you know, within our communities, and just go at it. And I think that Lauren, your work is awesome. You know, this show is an example of what can be done. You know, but how do you break the system mold? You know, other than from within, I think.
It's funny because Jen, you say the recovery community, and I remember in 1991 there being fights, slamming on the table. I am not in recovery. This is not about recovery. And then somebody else saying, well, maybe recovering what was stolen from me. You know what I mean? Like this was the beginnings of. Or already 10 years, by 85, six or 7 years into when the movement was bought out and the language started getting changed, used, and stuff like that, and people fighting about it, that this is not about, like, I come off sometimes very cold and maybe a little heartless, especially for people who don't know that, like, I still can't necessarily get out of the house every day. Like, just because I reject psychiatry doesn't mean I've got my shit together, you know? Oops, radio, sorry. you know, seriously. And that, you know, that there's this, so even by the early 90s, when I first got involved with the movement side of things, 91, 92, certainly by 95, that there was these conversations about the word recovery coming in. And in the 1850s, the word recovery was used all the time. And there's even a statement in the Opal from one of the Opalians that two-thirds of the hospital changes over each year from recovery. Wouldn't it be great if we could say the same of Congress? Like... and the Opalians, you know, they were the inmates of the Utica State Lunatic Asylum. They were writing these journals. And so in the American Journal of Insanity, where the institutions, all the state institutions, used to report their numbers in the American Journal of Insanity, which is today's American Journal of Psychiatry, published by the American Psychiatric Association. And in there, they would release the numbers recovered, in remission, or dead.
Yeah.
That was, you know, and so the idea that, so anyway, these recovery communities, I mean, even them, they were under contention. So, like, what is alternatives now was in the mid-80s, and or certainly before the mid-80s, and, you know, late 70s and through the 70s into the 80s, because the 12th annual International Conference on Psychiatric Oppression and Human Rights was in 1982. And 1985 was when the first Alternatives Conference. And so I think that when, you know, the federal government really had a very different idea of what they wanted people focusing on. And over the last 25, 35 years, they have successfully gotten people who are now getting paid in those positions that were originally this movement toward, you know, the mental patients movement, to say that the things that the mental patients movement says are not credible. You know, so when the leadership of the peer industry, or any of the leadership, this is very broad-based, and again, I like and respect a lot of these people, and some of these people I consider friends, so I get very complicated talking about this stuff because it's not personal. But when anybody from that leadership realm says that talking about things from a psychiatric survivor perspective or human rights or torture or any of this is not credible, they are who our movement, they got their jobs because of our movement. And then went and created this other stuff that the federal government would be willing to fund. And that's painful. That's sad. You know what I mean? And I think that needs to be reflected, and it needs and some of that leadership does. Some of that leadership says, "Hey, I never positioned myself as this radical quote unquote psychiatric survivor thing, and those people I respect because at least they don't pretend like that they're taking our values into account or that but I think it's hard, and that's why I think we need to not expect the federal government to be paying for us to do this, to not expect the pharmaceutical industries or anybody who would be benefiting from this, and that this idea of creating this alternatives to alternatives where we can really talk about how to get back to the roots. I mean, what would happen if all of a sudden everybody at alternatives like got up and turned their back on Patrick Kennedy when he started talking about everybody needing a checkup from the neck up? What would happen if 2,000 people, what would happen if 2,000 people collectively got up and walked out? But they can't have that. You know what I mean? And so that's where the problem is. So having to have, and so that's where the power is. And so how do you get to the power without the money? And how do you get the money out of this damn system so that people's lives, how much of this money is getting to the actual people, right? If your problem is that you don't have someplace to live, A pill is not going to solve that, and B, how much money are we spending on institutions? You can get somebody a 5-star hotel for 3 years for what you would charge 1 year in an institution.
Yeah. Well, this kind of talk is why I always come back and listen to this show, because it's really important. It's really important and empowering, and it really goes to the way that I look at things. Even though in so many ways we don't agree, but I, just love being with other people who are considering the same issues and really smart about it. And I'm, really kind of a radical person in my true heart of hearts, and I was just doing advocacy the past couple of days and had some lunch with a guy today, and we were talking about visions of revolution and stuff, and I really appreciate the show a lot and the analysis and the activism of those are who are for human rights. And even if I completely disagree, I don't think it would be valid or credible if I were the only one talking. I mean, I don't. I think if the only person who's credible would be someone like me that is willing to work within the system and change it a little bit or maybe a lot, but just change it incrementally, I think if I was the only one being heard, And the only thing I could do on behalf of others who were truly oppressed and harmed would be for me to say what I think they said. I mean, that would just be a travesty.
I mean, yeah. I mean, and I think, even in terms of, there are real people out there who really need things and who really are, living a crisis and who are having, whatever. And I truly believe that whatever it is, if you wipe out what is economic and you remove that as a factor, and then you add support and somebody who will just listen, and you come from a perspective of this person most likely has experienced something traumatic and may be in a group that is already oppressed, then you basically, on all levels, wiped out, and taken the environment into full account. Psychiatry is the problem that it has something to offer. You know what I mean? Like somebody who is really at the end of their rope, and you say, okay, you don't have to worry about a place to live. We've got this. We've got, people who are going to listen, and you're going to get, whatever kind of support you need. Psychiatry doesn't, A, do that, and B, they just give people drugs and institutions. And again, I'm not against drugs. I have no objection to drugs. I think people should be able to do whatever drugs that they want to do, with informed choice and informed consent. and that the drug should not be profited off of. But I think that people should be given the correct information about it and be able to make a decision and not be, you know, coerced or, you know, lies by omission. I mean, I think those are the bigger problems. You know what I mean? It's not even what you're told, it's what you're not told.
Well, I disagree with most of what you've just said as far as your conclusions, but I can't ever disagree with your experience and wisdom. I just think the specific facts are in dispute, that I don't agree with, you know, a lot of what you said.
Which, just out of curiosity, which parts?
All the stuff about psychiatry not being based on reality or science, but it basically being a whole fraud and that stuff.
But that's true.
Well, we and I disagree on that.
I mean, but you know, people say this, so this is part of, you know, the problem is that people then say, well, I'll respect your opinion if you respect mine. And it's like, but mine isn't an opinion. Mine is it's a fact. Psychiatry does not have any evidence for anything it suggests exists.
Well, you're wrong, Lauren.
No, I'm not wrong.
It doesn't have any.
So what is the evidence?
Well, I don't think a radio soundbite's the way to get at it, but I mean, there's libraries and libraries.
Of maybe someday, if perhaps we think we'd like, we have this patent.
Maybe we haven't read the same books or something.
I mean, I just, you know, the NIMH, there's no blood test, there's no genetic scan, there's no brain test, there's no evidence. I hope you both stay on the line, please, because this is going to get really interesting. Area code 646, your line is open. No, it's not.
Hey, Lauren, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Hi, Lauren.
It's Lester. Hi, how are you? Who am I on with?
Karen.
Okay,
it's,
Sharon.
And Gareth, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, great.
No, because I heard someone mention evidence, and I was like, wait, didn't we just get done with an entire, you know, human rights, Mind Freedom International thing where we had the big dude in charge at NYSDI admit that there was no evidence to support it, that there's no evidence that says an assigned psychiatric label actually exists, a biomedical model. It is because you happen to see a person for 45 minutes at one point in their life, you diagnose them. So, I don't know. If you're talking to me, I think it's more about the social ills of society, and for that there is no pill, no fix. The only way to fix that is actually look at really quality.
And quite frankly, even if there was some evidence and somebody did not want any of this stuff to be happening, that shouldn't be forced on them ever either. And so, you know, and for anybody who says, well, I wanted to be forced or whatever, my standard response, and I don't mean it sarcastically, I mean it seriously, is write it in an advance directive that you want to be forced when this, and this happens, or when this combination of things happen. Like, don't put all of us into this category of needing to be forced because you want somebody to step in and take responsibility for your life. Like, that is fine. I have no objection to that. If that's what you want, put it in an advance directive. Like, so I feel like that whole issue is, you know, like another whole problem where we wind up getting into these very nasty fights that become personal because it is personal for all of us. And I don't want it to be personal, yet it's conversations that really need to be had. And so I think it gets very complicated.
although I think the combinant, I think any conversation gets complicated, just like the ECT conversation gets complicated, because there are folks who swear by ECT and folks who will tell you it's the worst thing that ever happened.
You know, Lester, but I hear about these folks that swear by ECT, electric shock, all of the time. People mention them, but, well, anyway, I've personally never met somebody who swears by electric shock. So I don't, you know, just need to say that. But, Sharon, were you trying to say something?
Sorry. I would just like to go back to the evidentiary piece for a second. And Gareth had commented to me that apparently we hadn't read the same books. And she's right. There are libraries and libraries out there, and I love libraries. So, Gareth, I wonder if you could recommend to me a book that will explain the scientifically evident piece of mental illness to me.
Hi, this is Gareth. The answer is no, I am not an expert on mental illness literature, psychiatry, and I don't have anyone to recommend at all.
Thank you.
And I think the sad part here is that they don't really have any evidence. They have some correlations. And we all know that correlational is not causation. Correlation is not causation. And they have some theories. They have a lot of theories. And they have a lot of money. And they have a lot of state power. But they don't have any actual evidence. And so any single thing that you read, and I think that this is when I started this whole thing at the beginning with the textbooks, because now I've been reading textbooks for the last week of trying to figure out what textbooks I was going to use. And, you know, they all say this may be, we hope that this will lead to finding, you know, all these kinds of, like, potential kinds of situations, but no, like, affirmative statements anywhere, except all of the graphics, all of the pictures, all of the charts. Oh, you know, any like bolded language is as if, and you know the maybes are like in really small print at the bottom of the page where you know nobody is going to read anyway because there's 560 pages of this garbage and students don't read every single word.
What are you teaching?
I'm teaching four classes this semester. I'm teaching two intro to psychology, psychology of women, and developmental psychology. And I'm very excited about it all.
That's a load.
Yeah.
Which psychology? What was the last one, Lauren?
Psychology of women and developmental psychology.
Developmental psychology. Good luck.
Thanks. Yeah.
Well,
so it should be a great semester.
Maybe the good news about developmental, at least, is now that they're beginning to acknowledge that, quote-unquote, childhood trauma causes, quote-unquote, psychosis.
One of the reasons that I picked the book that I quote, I would never use that language, Lester. But one of the reasons, and everybody, just for anybody who doesn't know, Lester is a phenomenal friend and wonderful person and a great researcher and I've worked very closely with and was one of the study coordinators, participants, evaluators, planners, you know, get me through to the finish liners of the dissertation and who I've known for many, many years before that also. So I'm not being snippy with him I'm just being snippy with him because I've known him that long, but I appreciate him that much, and so I would not use that language, Lester. I would not use that language of childhood psychosis. But one of the reasons I picked the book of the psychology of women that I'm using is because it really addresses things from multiple levels, and the developmental psychology book specifically looks at things from social cultural history and an ecological model and has all of that built into it from the start. So I really appreciate that they're not just simply biological, genetic kind of books, but there's a lot of that in, it's hard to find a textbook that doesn't have that line in it. So it's easy to imagine, Gareth, for example, why somebody would say, but no, they have plenty of evidence. Of course they have evidence. How could they not have evidence, Lauren? Do you think that people would be putting all of this money and time and energy and power and prestige into this field if they didn't have any evidence, Lauren? Like, that's what the average person says. And
yes.
Then when you really start, because of how the media, the books, the field itself, I mean, you know, the APA's, the American Psychiatric Association's theme this year for their annual conference was, how do we improve our image, right? Like, I forget exactly what their words were, but, like, restorying ourselves, you know?
Not possible at this point.
And focusing on the veterans. And focusing on the veterans, trying to figure out how are they going to repackage themselves to get the veterans to buy into what it is they had to offer. And when I say buy in, I mean literally buy.
Lauren, I offer to help develop the brand and promote them, and you know, to do the right thing. I mean, I would love to help them with their reshaping, quote unquote, of their image and brand.
Oh Jesus.
Yeah, if only. I mean, unfortunately, they're...
How would I do that? Oh, my God. Let me count the ways.
I don't know. Maybe you can go... Maybe they can just give people bottles of oxytocin to spray up their noses as people are walking by, and people just have the natural desire to bond with them and you know, like, whatever. It's just so irritating. It really truly is. And at the same time that there are these people who are not getting help, who are not getting what they need, models like Soteria House, you know, from Lauren Mosher's resignation to the APA that I was reading before, you know, this anything that works is, you know, discarded.
Yep.
I think, you know, just scrolling down to the bottom of Mosher's letter, it says, he wrote in 1998, what do I recommend to the organization upon leaving after experiencing 3 decades of its history? One, to begin with, let us be ourselves. Stop taking on unholy alliances without the members' permission. Two, get real about science, politics, and money. Label each for what it is, that is, be honest. Three, get out of bed with NAMI and the drug companies. APA should align itself, if one believes its rhetoric, with the true consumer groups, i.e. the ex-patients, psychiatric survivors, et cetera. And four, talk to the membership. I can't be alone in my views. We seem to have forgotten a basic principle, the need to be patient-client-consumer satisfaction-oriented. I always remember Manfred Bleuler's wisdom. Quote, Lauren, you must never forget that you are your patient's employee. In the end, they will determine whether or not psychiatry survives in the service marketplace. Unfortunately, I mean, while he saw the psychopharmacological association connection there, I don't think even he could have envisioned how the money took all of this over again, and that people just don't even have a choice.
I think that's the saddest part, is that people don't have a real choice in that. We only give them this particular choice, so it is no choice at all. And I think,
and that,
you know,
we're not creating Soteria houses. That there isn't. Why isn't there a
right.
Soteria house in every single neighborhood? Why isn't there? You know what I mean? Why isn't this kind of alternative way of looking at the situation available everywhere? Especially, like, in rural communities. You know what I mean? Where you're not going to have a big institution. Like, Soteria houses would probably be the perfect kind of thing for a rural community. What, thoughts?
I think so. I think but you have to find, for example, a dilapidated building, and then you would need to get buy-in from, like, Home Depot or Lowe's.
I'm wondering about... Yeah. I mean, absolutely, you need community stuff, but for Jen, for somebody who's actively working, or Gareth, who's been in rural communities actively working, why aren't there Soteria houses all over the place?
Well, I'll tell you why. I mean, come on, you know, Georgia, we're in the South, okay? South is huge.
Well, if you look at a map of all the, for the marketplace right now for healthcare, look at the states that are largely certified, you know, Medicaid, non-expansion states. It's Georgia, Texas, South Carolina, North Carolina, and, you know, going all the way down, going all the way up that area, that's the majority of the South of the U.S. And so why aren't there any such area houses in Georgia? Hello? We're in the South. It's not going to fly.
Well, that's no excuse.
There's no excuse. I mean, we have fantastic organizations in Georgia, foremostly the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network, which is awesome.
There's so many issues, and like the whole Medicaid issue and Medicaid billable peer services that came out of Georgia is, you know, part of like what we're battling in New York. But I don't think the answer is that in Georgia it's not like that because you're in the South, because in New York it's not like that, and we're in the North.
I do have to tell you that we do have quite a few peer respite centers and peer wellness centers through GMHCN, which Larry Fricks, you know, is so key, and Beth Filson and you know, Ben Acorn and all sorts of people. You know, they're really good people, and the services that have come out for peer service, you know, like, for instance, respite. But it's not a soteria. The soteria can fly in some ways, say, for instance, Vermont or in Alaska. You know, and look at what Parachute's doing in New York.
Parachute should be shut down. I don't know what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
You know, and for instance, you know, so I think if we look at the model for making soteria work, it's beautiful. It's totally beautiful. And I think it's possible. I think a lot of it's going to take a gatekeeper, a champion of soteria and the concept and the model, and being able to sell it. And then once you sell it, being able to get the buy. And then once you get that, actually developing the program, making sure it's entirely peer-run, peer-led, as a cost should be, and have it be recovery-based. I'm sorry, there's a lot of things that are real basic to the model. So why isn't it getting done? I guess that's my basic question, because it seems to make sense to me.
Yeah, I don't know why they're not all over the country or all over the world, or that these aren't just available to people. They're cheaper, they're cost-effective, they work better, they have better long-term outcomes, and it meets on so many levels, you know, long before Olmstead ever came down, you know, the least restrictive kind of thing, that it's not restrictive, that it's in the community, that it's not... And so I think that we need to keep focus on it, but also, you know, the whole idea of, you know, New York is really in this challenge right now of where we have successfully maintained not going Medicaid billable for decades or a decade or more, and now it's happening to us, and we're, you know, there are many of us who are very, very upset and concerned about this and feel like it's going to really destroy whatever genuine authenticity was left in what was happening, and you know, because mutual support and mutual assistance has been pretty much wiped out in New York.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, the white paper that I recently published with Pam Hardin, I was talking to a very good friend of mine and colleague, and she said, Jen, in your paper, you didn't mention mutuality at all. And I was like, no, actually, we did. You know, because I don't know if you've read the white paper that came out back in June that we talk about being able to utilize a certified career specialist and a recovery coach and a community health worker, promotora, in an integrated physical and behavioral health care setting model. But the only way that would work is if we led it and if we were the people that were providing oversight.
See,
and
this
quote
is,
unquote, you know.
Jen, I did see it. If you would send me the link, I honestly didn't read it because I knew I would just, like, yell and scream, and I didn't want to yell and scream because I'd been yelling and screaming all over the place for 1,000 other reasons. And I don't mean that in a bad way. But
what would you be yelling and screaming about?
You know, I think part of the problem is when you talk with people who 20 years ago were establishing these positions in New York, and you ask them, okay, 20 years later, what do you think about this? They will routinely say, oh, if I knew that this is what was going to happen to what it was we were talking about, I would have never done this. And so I think that that's the thing that's missing on a large scale in most of the peer-run kinds of places.
Let's talk about that. I want to talk about that with you.
Yeah, because it's been so many generations. It's been so many generations down, because what was originally written in many situations wasn't really what we were talking about, but what was able to get through whatever state bureaucracy was being dealt with. And so it was already watered down from what it was we were talking about, but we all knew. And so as long as we were doing it and we were training people, then we would be able to get that message across and those relationships would be able to develop and people would get what it was really about. I think over time, where you have all of these people who have now gone through train the trainers and all this other stuff, and a couple of people who step over the line in different directions that cause them to lose their jobs, and new people come in, and they don't know what was originally supposed to be in there because that was all taken out with the idea that we were going to be able to continue doing it because we knew. But then you add that and you add another 5 years or 10 years to the process, and you have thousands of people who are trained on this thing that wasn't really what we were talking about, who have no idea what it was we were talking about, and then see what we were talking about as not credible.
I can see that. You know, I see where you're coming from. I get it. So I guess what I would be interested in talking with you at greater length, you know, I mean, we don't have to monopolize the thing now, is how do you have a type of guaranteed, quote unquote, mutuality, you know, in these positions and that are beginning to be professionalized.
Well, that's the whole thing, because they weren't, and they weren't supposed to be. It wasn't an industry. It wasn't a jobs program. It wasn't about getting people jobs. It wasn't about It was about creating an alternative message to get to people who were locked up and help those people who are locked up get out like we got out. But it wasn't about creating all kinds of... It became like a snowball of an industry almost overnight. And once they realized that they could get money for it and that they could charge less money than they were charging for social workers or other people, the state really bought into that. And so it just became this thing, and over the country, I mean, I've heard people call it the fastest growing industry in healthcare. And so so when you can't go out for a cup of coffee with somebody who is when you're a peer to them, and yet you can't go out for coffee or forget about having a relationship, you know, what kind of quote unquote peer are you? You're not a peer. You're just another person who has some level of power over them, who is also being watched by this system and has a whole different set of rules that they have to go by and are treated a whole different way. You know, because they're a peer and they're not really a, you know, provider, even if they're a peer provider, you know, so they're more suspect. I mean, you know, so it's a very unnatural thing, and it was never supposed to be this. It was never supposed to be this. And so, you know, I think that's...
Okay, can I ask you a question? Have you ever worked as a certified peer specialist in the field, in any kind of field, in any kind of area of expertise, say for example, housing, employment, job development, PR. I'm not done. And going across the gamut of helping with public health education promotion, with reducing chronic diseases and chronic illnesses, and but working with a comorbidity. And I mean, have you ever done that?
I that was a really loaded question that I could pick apart for a long time. I've first of all, there is no certification in New York State. The certification has just come in, and many of us are still fighting about it. Second of all, I have worked in quote-unquote peer roles throughout my life. Many of them starting when I was 19 years old as a, I think my first title was peer counselor. I've had multiple roles in the system. Some of those roles were writing the trainings for what peers should be getting trained in. And some of them were active.
I never knew that about you. And, you know, and guess who trained me for my CPS? Guess. One guess.
I have no idea.
Larry Fricks, Ike Powell, Beth Filson, Georgia Appalachian Consulting Group. You know, it was a five-day training that I took in 2007 in Austin, Texas with DBSA National. You know, Linda Goodell is fantastic, I think. And it changed my life. For me, I wasn't active back in the 80s, 90s. I mean, I was formally diagnosed with something in 1995 or 6. And when I got to start doing what I do now, I started off volunteering, and then, you know, I kind of continued it, and here I am, you know. So I think that the CPS and the recovery coach are interesting in how they work together, because the certified peer specialist is largely mental illness, mental health, and the RC is substance abuse and addictions. And the basic philosophy, I think, coming out of the RC communities, people that I've talked to that provide RCs, is that we refuse to get certified. We don't want to get certified, because if we're certified and start getting paid money for it, we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing.
That's right.
You know, and I was talking to a guy in Texas, up in El Paso, about this, and the struggle is that the population is being affected so vastly, you know, across the board right now with everything going on with mental health and substance abuse and addictions and trauma, you know, and VA is coming back, and PTSD and everything, and the climate that we have right now, is that you need to be able to afford to pay somebody to do that work, because there's so many, because the need is so great. And a lot of people just don't work for free anymore.
Well, I think, you know, I also started out volunteering. Actually, most of my work for the last 10 years has been volunteering, because nobody will pay me. You know, and that's the truth. No, very, very few people will pay me. But I do think that, you know, and I want to say before I forget, you mentioned Ike Powell, and the very, very, very first time that I had any kind of training or input from anybody in the adults movement, is how we called it, because I came out of the youth movement, was Ike Powell and Ed Knight, when we had a youth summit with the New York City field office people and young people who were locked up in institutions in the early 90s, had to be like 93 or 92 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so I share some of that with you, you know, and I've, you know, gone further. But I also, at a very young, and I mean young in terms of young in the movement and also being a young person, but I was very fresh involved with what, when I first got involved as a consumer, where I bought it. I was on medication. I was voluntarily complying. I was going to groups. I was doing all kinds of, you know, getting on stage as like the dog and pony show for the psychiatrist. And luckily, I credit saving my life that I stumbled over George Ebert and the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance, and that immediately altered every thought I ever had. And within a very short time, I was fired and institutionalized. and we actually got the state to move the money out of that program, and I got out of the institution, and we became Stage 2 Youth Empowerment. And now it exists, and I have nothing to do with it, and they're phenomenal, and it's called Youth Power. And they're a phenomenal group of young people who are just doing incredible advocacy and activism and policy change and stuff like that. So, I mean, like, you know, I'm really coming from this, like, hardcore from having these very early experiences of really experiencing that betrayal of having these people having me live in fear, and in like compliance with them, to really questioning it, and you know, I'm so that's part of where my hardness comes of all of this toward psychiatry, because if I listened to them, if I was still alive, I would be you know, cut in ham at the back of a deli somewhere, which is the job that they thought I had, and you know, going to program 3 days a week and taking whatever drugs they wanted me to be taking. And so the only reason I'm where I'm at is because I rejected it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think though it goes to some degree. I mean, I can tell you about by the time I got trained here in New York City, and I was trained at Howie the Harp. And
Howie would be rolling, for anybody who knows Howie, I have to say this, he would be rolling in his grave if he knew what was happening in his name. Go ahead.
I figured you would. But when I took the training, I didn't even know my history. That's scary. I didn't even know the movement existed. I had to leave Howie the Harp, and I became the intern for the New York City Field Office Director of Recipient Affairs for New York City. I became her intern. From there, she looked at me straight in the face one day and she said to me, you need to go be around your peers. And to get all this biomedical model stuff. You need to go talk and hang out with your peers. And she sent me up to Westchester to do that. And I took they call it the New York, Westchester, Rockland Advocacy Coalition. I think that's the way it's described.
NIRAC.
And I took this training. And in that training, I began to have stuff questioned about me. I mean, everyone from probably dissident psychiatrist Peter Stastny, who talked about schizophrenia and psychiatrist's obsession with schizophrenia, to George Ebert, who came in one day and began talking about all this stuff, and I learned that I had a history. I learned from where it is I came. I learned that I come from a human rights activist movement and that I wasn't supposed to get caught in the model. All these things I began to learn. And I think that's where some of my unwillingness, I would say, not to have the values of that movement embedded into everything we do, whether it is, you know, Judy Chamberlain and Sally Zinman's On Our Own Together, or Judy Chamberlain's On Our Own, or, you know, whatever it is, to not honor the history of who we are and what we do, I think it's where we get screwed in the process. Because I think that's where the split in the community is, because there are those of us who will honor the integrity and the history and the rich history we have, and those who will just see it as, well, if the providers are saying how great and wonderful we are, well, then that's good enough for us. And there are those of us who say, oh, hell no, 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 wait. No. There's an integrity that goes with working in peer support. There's an integrity that is built into the model that you must honor and respect, and it is because other people gave their lives in order for us to be able to do what we do.
And quite frankly, even in New York, that integrity doesn't exist anymore, because we're in the process of going Medicaid billable and being certified and all this other crap. And so when even people who are in the most committed places trying to really, so anything within the system is going to be a problem. But the idea of, like, a paid position where somebody is called a peer and on every single level they are in no way an equal to the person that they are supposed to be, you know, you're just another level of assigned worker.
It is, and for those who think Parachute New York City is great, I worked in it. Parachute New York City is a man-made hell. And I wasn't fired because I couldn't do my job. I was fired because not only could I do my job, but because of my politics. And that's problematic because that was supposed to be the model that was going to shift the paradigm in this city, and it has yet to do it. I honestly say it, it's like neoconservatism. We're going to create a kinder, gentler mental patient. Still going to create a mental patient, just kinder and gentler. They're going to be more willing to be compliant. They're going to be more willing to take the meds. They're going to be more willing to buy into the biomedical model. And that's what you want. You want them to buy into biopsychiatry.
I think it is, I think that these are major issues. And I think in places where it's already happened, where, you know, the person, the people who are, you know, you were trained by the people who created this certification and the idea of this being Medicaid billable. And so your perspective is going to be radically different than ours, right? I mean, and it's not a personal thing. It's just that what you were taught fundamentally through this whole process was literally coming from the people who created this being Medicaid billable. What Lester and I were taught fundamentally was literally by the people who have been trying to stop this from happening. Right?
Uh-huh. Yep.
So, I mean, that's part of the problem is that we're already all generations down from where it was, but that fundamental training that we all had in what it was we were doing will continue this. And so just like in many ways our mentors were at odds, they put us in positions of, because of the values, because of what it is that we are going for, it puts us in positions of where we're at odds because we're working for different things.
I think we are working for different things, but I don't think that our trainers have, like, captivated our minds forever. I think that we can think for ourselves and that I disagree with my trainers about a lot of stuff, and I'm sure that all of us do.
Well, I have a hard time when the history chooses to rewrite itself to make a white male and have him be the victor, i.e. Larry Frick, and they don't ever mention Celia Brown, who is truly the matriarch, because she did it first. She did it. And there is never the acknowledgement of this woman of color and who she is, and that without her, none of us would have been employed. And I have a real problem when they choose knowingly and willingly to not honor the integrity of their history, because it's much easier for them to say, well, she's only a woman of color through it. There's something inherently wrong with that modality of thinking. And that, to me, is the typical way we write history. We write history in terms of the victor. And if we don't like the outcome of the history the way it was originally written, white folks tend to want to go turn around and rewrite it. And that's exactly what's happened here. And I have a real problem. That's why I have a real problem with some of the stuff that's out there regarding peer specialists. Because there's no honoring the matriarch of what it is to be a peer specialist. I have a problem. I'm sorry. Never was meant to be a cog in the model. We weren't. That's not who we are. That's not what we were supposed to do. We were supposed to shamelessly, relentlessly agitate this system. And we don't do that anymore. We use all the biomedical model jargon. We don't remember that we come from a human rights framework, that it's a human rights activist. That's why we're here. That's what we were supposed to focus on. Rights. Choice. Informed choice. And what that means. We don't do that. You have providers and peers who are writing the job descriptions for us, or providers alone writing the job description for us.
I mean, when you have, I mean, that's the whole issue. But when it's beyond that, there's no equality in the relationship between two people. But then where there's some level of leverage in the way that you're used in order to get other people to do things that they want you to do, such as, you know, convince somebody to give their urine, or, you know,
right.
show up at somebody's house and make sure that they're taking their drugs, or to, you know, to get, you know, get them to come in. Or what's worse on some levels of acting in these ways of where people are like junior case managers, you know, doing this job at a, you know, pittance of what it is they would have to pay somebody who is a licensed social worker, and you know, running around and, you know, acting as this person's, you know, guard. And if the person steps out of line and trying to convince them. And then the other big danger that nobody ever talks about and when in these peer-run programs or peer positions is that the people who are in them are under more speculation. They are not out of the system themselves. They are at greater risk of being reinstitutionalized because they're coming in contact with providers every single day where they're working under the auspice that they're all equals and they're not. And so when your behavior doesn't meet your employer's satisfaction, you're more likely to be institutionalized than if you were not out about your psychiatric history. And I think that that's something that every peer worker needs to be aware of, and it's not ever discussed, and that people's, you know, quote-unquote stability come under challenge. You know, and at the same time, I understand people want to do something for people who are in the system, and it's the way to get into the system. And that's a side of it, and that's a reality of it that also needs to be addressed. But you know, how much if you're compromising on, and I'm not saying either of you are doing this, but I'm saying in general, if you can't print the word advocacy in your materials, like, you know, was the issue with alternatives in 2008 in New York, how are you supposed to tell people that this conference is about advocacy? And so that, you know, we need to be honest, and we need to, you know, and psychiatry needs to be honest about what it can and can't do. You know, I think it would have a lot more customers if it said, look, we can give you these drugs, or we can, like, you know, hole you up in a room for a couple of days if you just need to be alone, you know, but they don't say that, and they're now going further and pretending like they have some kind of solutions to these vile, heinous crimes that are being committed, as if they would be able to spot it and stop it, and this is going to create so many more huge problems going forward. So I only has went so fast, I just looked at the time. We only have a couple of minutes left, and I just wanted to thank you, Jen and Sharon and Gareth and Lester, for calling in. And I really do hope that we can continue this conversation. And Gareth, will you please remember to send me an email again, and I will send you the final draft of the dissertation. You know, maybe we can schedule something. And, Jen, will you send me a link of that white paper? Because I will read it, and I do know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I will.
Well, you want to know, Lauren, you got to say 1C120. I read the white paper.
I'm sorry, wait a second. Wait a second.
I read the white paper that Jen wrote, and I said the only thing that I would say to you is that the peers who are working in these positions are the last lines of social justice. And to leave out the social justice piece is wrong. If anything, the peer specialist should be very knowledgeable in social determinants of health, the ACE study, and trauma-informed. And, Jen, honestly, I got to say,
absolutely,
Lauren, she agreed with me.
Yeah. I mean, being trauma-informed, you know, with is such a sound. It's just a basic infrastructure for organizations, but also just for us doing this, you know, and helping others. But I think it's also something that we all should really learn, you know, I guess on an individual level and basis. I know when I took it at the GMHCM, I took trauma-informed peer support, social change, and trauma healing with Beth Phillipson at the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network last June, and it was great. But, you know, Beth is phenomenal, and everyone should do it.
Great. We have 10 seconds left. Again, please send me that link. Thanks for everybody. If you If you'd like to be on the show or have an idea for a show, call the Talk with Tenny tip line, 718-273-8708. Have a great night. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Thanks, everyone.